And welcome back to Current State. And we hope it's not too late to say Happy New Year. It's our first Current State of 2017. In fact, next weekend marks the beginning of our fifth year of shows here on 90.5 WKAR. We are glad you are a part of it. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan will lead the nation in creating 21st century infrastructure systems. Those ambitious words begin the summary of a recent report from Governor Snyder's 21st Century Infrastructure Commission. The 188-page report looked decades into the future to determine how to improve the state's water, transportation, energy, and communication systems. Commissioner Janice Beecher, a Michigan State University infrastructure expert, told me she's pleased with the results of the group's 8 months of work.
I feel really good about it. It was a very constructive process. I think we did our due diligence in developing the recommendations. I think the breadth of knowledge of the commissioners and the support that we had from the staff was tremendous. So I think we accomplished what we set out to do, and we did it on time, which is always a good feeling as well. But I also view the report as not the end, but the beginning. The report lays a foundation, and now the hard work comes after that.
Asset management was a part of this report, and recommendations were made regarding asset management. Just briefly, what is asset management and what needs to happen on that front?
Well, one of the challenges we had was understanding the nature of our infrastructure, the condition of our infrastructure, even where it's located.
Existing infrastructure,
exactly.
What's already there.
Exactly, what we have underground and above ground. And that's a challenge not just for Michigan, but really across the country. So asset management is now a tool that's available for maintaining a better sense of what you have, its value, and how you're going to maintain that value over time. So investing in infrastructure really goes hand in hand with an asset management plan.
You and I spoke about how the headline in stories like these becomes the price tag, and it's colossal here, $4 billion a year for 20 years. Have you thought about how we move forward with that 800-pound gorilla hanging over the conversation?
Right. The dollar sign always gets the headline. And in some ways, that's unfortunate because it overwhelms the other important findings of a report like this, which were, the recommendations, but also the principles behind those recommendations. And those will be what moves us forward. So, yes, we do have a major challenge in terms of the funding that we're going to have to address. But I think the report lays out a good blueprint for starting that process. And I think we have, some very constructive recommendations that can be pursued pretty quickly.
Mike Nystrom, another member of the commission with you, struck a more optimistic tone when he joined me recently. He suggested he's hopeful that the legislature and state government can begin acting on some of these recommendations really quickly, almost like now. Do you think that's possible?
I agree. I think we can have an opportunity to. I think we have an opportunity here to begin an asset management approach for the state. I also think the ideas in the report regarding a pilot program and establishment of an infrastructure council can be acted on almost immediately.
What might be acted on sooner as opposed to later?
Well, I think there are communities that would be ready to engage in a pilot program, and that could happen rather quickly. I think other aspects of the report obviously require a longer timeline, but I think that there's no reason why not to start implementing some of these ideas right away.
You've also said that rebuilding Michigan's infrastructure requires a thoughtful approach to the way it will impact communities and residents. Tell us more about that, please.
Well, one thing we know about infrastructure, especially when it relates to public utility services like water and energy, these are essential services, and their affordability is very important. When we price utilities, we also know it can sometimes have regressive impacts. In other words, it takes a larger share of the low-income family's household budget. So we need to be cognizant when we move toward pricing models like user fees, that we're aware of the impact and that we consider possible mitigating measures to ensure affordability.
I'm talking with Dr. Janice Beecher of Michigan State University, an infrastructure expert and a member of Governor Snyder's recent Infrastructure Commission, the report from which just came out and recommended significant investment in Michigan's infrastructure looking decades into the future. You look at infrastructure from the university, and so much of this involves government and therefore politics. Have you given much thought to how government and elected officials overcome the political hurdles that are involved here?
One of the phrases we're all familiar with is NIMBY, not in my backyard. And a few years ago, I heard the expression NIMTU, not in my term of office. And I think that sort of captures the challenge of trying to engage political leaders on this issue as well as the public. So you're absolutely right. It's going to take political will. It's going to take leadership. But I think it's doable because I think the return on investment is very, very clear. And I think if we if we do engage the public, I think they may, based on our experience with the listening tours that we had as part of the commission, we heard a lot from people about how much they cared about these issues and the quality of the infrastructure and the services that they get. So I think with the right combination of, of a nonpartisan effort and a communication strategy, I think it's doable.
I hesitate to remind you of this, but government is littered with reports about policy, some number of which don't go anywhere. But are you confident your commission's report will have an impact?
I hope so. As I said, I like to think of it as a living document. One of the ways it can have more meaningful impact is that we don't rely only on the public sector to pick up on the recommendations. We've also engaged the private sector in the process. We also will engage local government. It will also involve university researchers here at Michigan State, at U of M, at Wayne State. They can also pick up on some of the ideas and recommendations in the report and help carry those forward.
And there is a job creation possibility that's a part of this as well.
Clearly. I think, when we think about infrastructure, we should also think about the workforce that's needed, various skills, and frankly, the emerging technologies. We have a strong emphasis on that in the report. And those are areas where we can clearly move ahead and, I think, do some great things for Michigan.
We've been talking with Dr. Janice Beecher of Michigan State University, an infrastructure expert and a member of Governor Snyder's recent Infrastructure Commission. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks and Happy New Year.
And coming up on Current State, after 40 years in business, the East Lansing Food Co-op is closing its doors. The customer-owned enterprise is losing money to bigger competitors, but the little store is hoping for a big comeback someday. WKAR's Kevin Lavery has the story coming up. It's Current State on WKAR. The number of substitute teachers have been declining in Michigan. WKAR's Katie Cook takes a look at why.
Michigan is experiencing a shortage of substitute teachers. One way the shortage can be measured is by the fill rate. That's the percentage of open substitute positions that get filled. In 2012, the fill rate in Michigan was about 95%, and today it has dropped as low as 85%. So for every 100 classrooms that need subs, about 15 aren't getting them.
You know what that typically does is it leads to what we call a scramble plan at the district. It's a pretty big disruption chain of command.
That's Clark Galloway, president of EduStaff. They provide subs to more than 300 of Michigan's 500 districts. Galloway says this scrambling disrupts everyone at the school, from the other substitutes to teachers and principals.
And so whether it be one absence that day or 10 absences that day, it really is affecting the leaders and the teachers at the school district, but most importantly, it's affecting the quality of education.
Galloway says this is an issue nationwide.
We're starting to see fill rates across the nation declining, and the statistics that we're facing in central Michigan are not that far off of what we see in national trends.
So what's causing the decline in substitute teachers?
What we are finding is the biggest key or the biggest factor is really the overall economic factor. It's really the fact that we are trying to obtain candidates to work from the same general pool of employees that we are competing with other employers.
The decline is also an indication that interest in pursuing teaching is dwindling.
the percentage of people who are going into education has declined in the state of Michigan. I would say easily a 30 to 40% decline in the local colleges and universities and their educational programs has reduced the amount of qualified, certified teachers that are coming into the substitute teacher pool.
Galloway says the typical substitute 10 years ago was fresh out of college with a teaching certificate, hoping to land a teaching job. Today, the typical sub is a female in her 40s without a teaching certificate, returning to the workforce. But there are still some out there who are pursuing full-time teaching, and they see substituting as a means to that end.
I feel like it's the most important job in the world. It really makes you feel good about what you do at the end of the day.
29-year-old Tony Blauvelt lives in Oak Park, Michigan, and substitutes in several school districts.
It's fun, engaging. It allows you to infuse a lot of creativity into what you do. In spite of whatever, you know, challenges come with it, it's still what I love to do.
He is currently substituting and working toward his master's degree in education so he can teach full time. He has some ideas for what might increase the number of substitutes.
I guess the incentive would be stronger if maybe subs weren't privatized. Maybe if subs could be hired by a district and know they have a home to go to where they get to know a staff and students really well, if they got paid better, if they had benefits.
In an effort to recruit, EduStaff has put billboards across the state, spreading the word about the need for substitutes. Galloway says more needs to be done, but he's optimistic.
You know, it takes time. It can't necessarily be done in 1 year. I will say that from what I can tell at the legislature level, whether someone's a Democrat or Republican, we're finding that more and more people are listening to the needs of education, and it looks to me like maybe some good solutions may be emerging.
And in the meantime, substitutes like Blauvelt will stay the course because he finds working with his students so gratifying.
Some of them have told me they genuinely learned from me. And that's a rewarding feeling because as a sub, you know, at times you're a glorified babysitter. And when students tell you, I really learned from you, or students say, you know, you made me a different person, that's the greatest thing you could ever ask for.
For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A mid-Michigan community institution is facing a hard decision. On Sunday, the owners of the East Lansing Food Co-op will vote on a motion to sell its building on Northwind Avenue. The co-op is facing stiff economic pressure from nearby competitors, and while a shutdown seems inevitable, its investors and patrons hope to resurrect the very idea that made the co-op a 40-year success. WKAR's Kevin Lavery has the story.
N.Y. Woody has been shopping at Elfco, as it's affectionately known, for almost as long as the building has stood on its site just off Grand River Avenue. The small green-roofed building tucked away on Northwind is dwarfed by the big Hobby Lobby across the street. These days, Elfco finds itself in another huge shadow cast from just a block away. Last April, retail giant Whole Foods Market opened a new store in East Lansing, bringing with it its nationally known organic pedigree. Elfco board president Ann Wywoody believes her little store is falling victim to its own trendiness.
For several years, the food co-op has been not making money. We've had competition growing and a number of other factors that have played in making us less competitive. And to a certain extent, it's a story of the success of what we started 40 years ago. You can find the kinds of things that were only available at the food co-op 40 years ago in almost every grocery store today. We have farmers markets that are providing outlets for local farmers so that they're being sustained when not too long ago the food co-op was one of the very few places that directly bought from farmers. But because of that, we are at the point where we're having to make some difficult financial decisions, and we will be having an owner meeting on the next Sunday, January 8th, 2 p.m. at the Allen Neighborhood Center, to decide whether to sell the building that we own and occupy today.
At what point did it start to become apparent that this was the course? And another way of saying this is, obviously you have Whole Foods Market brand new across the street. Did this begin before Whole Foods got here?
It did start a few years ago, and I think we're one of the things that we want to do is to be clear on when we move forward, that we're really understanding all the forces at work. Today, national grocery stores are, like Kroger is the largest seller of organic foods in the country, from what I understand. Good news for the access to organic food, but it means that we have competition across the board. The Whole Foods decision to site literally a block and a half away, closer than any other Whole Foods to any food cooperative in the country, has had a direct impact. But we had seen the decline over time. And because of that, and I should say that's not just from competition. There were a variety of other factors that played into this. Reconstruction of Grand River had an impact, a whole range of things. And we also have another local competitor who's been down the road for a few years, Foods for Living, which has provided some competition as well. So it's been a long process. Unfortunately, a lot of cooperatives around the country are facing the same kinds of stresses, and that's why what we're looking to do is to really re-look at what it is that's important about the co-op, which is this local ownership and providing a service to the community, not just being a food store.
If it's no longer feasible to run a co-op here in this location, you're saying you want to keep the corporation, mm-hmm. keep the infrastructure. What makes you so sure that starting another venture somewhere else in this region will be just as successful, that you won't find the same market forces there in whatever shape that is that are bringing about the closure of this facility?
That's something that we don't know yet. What we do know is there are a lot of parts of our community, the greater Lansing community, that are poorly served by grocery stores today. And we've actually been approached by a number of areas over the past number of years, from downtown East Lansing to the east side of Lansing to the Rio Town area, to consider opening a satellite store. We've examined it. One of the challenges was that by being owners of this building, we're actually tied here. It's hard for us to just pick up and consider moving or setting up a satellite. So we know that there's interest out there. We happen to be in an area where there are an enormous number of grocery stores within just a 5-mile radius. But this is part of what we'll be examining. We're not going to dissolve the corporation. That's not the plan right now. Our hope is to rebirth the food co-op, find a better location. There are many parts of this area that are not well served by grocery stores, and to continue this idea that locally owned is an extremely important criteria.
Shiloh Doms shares that hope. She's the co-op's outreach manager. I ask her to show me a favorite item in the store, and she leads me to the produce section, locally sourced, of course.
Now, my 3-year-old son, every time he comes in here, he has to pick out an apple. He walks right over, and he grabs the one he wants, and then I have to, you know, if I'm not keeping total eye on him, I have to see which one it was.
Is it no mistake that an apple is the logo of Elfco?
It's not a mistake. I mean, we get our apples from Elmar, and they're out of Flushing, Michigan. And I've been to Elmar, and it's wonderful. It's a great family activity to go to them. But if you can't make it to Flushing in a pinch, you come to Elfco and you buy, you know, we've got Northern Spy and Topaz and Honeycrisp. And then we've got bagged bulked apples, too.
I'm really passionate about co-ops, and the reason is that it is because it's a way to, for me, opt out of corporate control of, you know, our food system and you know, a lot of other things. And so it's my activism. I use food as my activism. Everybody eats. And so I feel like we really do need to still exist in some form and service the community. And I would love to see people, you know, especially, you know, if they feel like they've lost control in our political or economic or whatever schemes, you know, that they might be inspired to come and join us in in reimagining ELFCO to be something that works for everyone here.
At the register, Gary Garbardino is finishing his purchase.
How long have you been a member?
Probably going on 30 years now since I moved to Lansing. Wow.
Well, what's been the attraction of this particular store when you have other options around you?
The selection of the food and how well they treat the people who come here.
Things have not been very profitable as of late, and so they're going ahead with proceedings for closure. Your thoughts on this?
I hope they can find another location. This is just a building, so the co-op is much more than a building.
Would you still be involved in a new enterprise if it came to that?
I will continue to shop wherever it is.
Under its bylaws, the East Lansing Food Co-op must vote whether to dispose of its assets, that is, sell the building. Board President Ann Wywoody says it's not a done deal yet. She's already heard the suggestion of leasing the property. As a co-op leader, Wywoody says she's expecting an energetic discussion with an engaged group of people who'll decide what happens next.
Our purposes go beyond simply providing food. They are about serving the community, and you'll find that in our purposes as a cooperative as well as our policies. Our goal is to be of value to the people of this community, and that's why we're not simply going out of business. We're looking to rebirth ourselves to be consistent with what we think the community needs, and we're looking forward to hearing from people, we have been for quite a while, but about the opportunities that they think are out there for the cooperative to serve.
But stand by for some sort of a transformation in 2017.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's clearly happening. It's hard on all of us who have, I've been a member, our family's been a member since the early 80s, and this is where I do 90% of my shopping. So I actually have been thinking, where on earth am I going to shop? That's a tough thing to do. I'm looking forward to the possibility that we will come back better, stronger, serving the community more effectively. And so that opportunity is something I'm looking forward to.
Ann Wywoody is president of the board of directors of the East Lansing Food Co-op. The owners and members of the co-op will be meeting on Sunday to discuss the future plans for the co-op and proceeding with the sale. Thank you, Ann, for your time.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
On the way, 2017 is an election year in Lansing with voters choosing a mayor and four city council members. Our Scott Pohl talks with Burl Schwartz of the Lansing City Pulse about Lansing politics for the coming year. Stay close. It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. You're listening to Current State here every Saturday and Sunday on 90.5 WKAR. Some of our segments were recorded several days ago. There may have been later related developments. Glad you could join us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. There have been some legendary pairings. There was Abbott and Costello, cookies and milk, and then there's books and coffee. Last week, WKAR's Jamie Paisley got under the covers to a rather special device in the MSU library.
There is a cafe located on the first floor of the Michigan State University Library. It serves the usual goods you'd expect, you know, light snacks and a few beloved liquid forms of caffeine. But one floor above it, there is an espresso machine.
Hello, my name is Julie Taylor. I'm the espresso book machine coordinator at Michigan State University Libraries.
Julie's been in charge of the espresso book machine, or EBM, since April of this year.
My previous job, I worked for a book wholesaler and distributor, and they were interested in one, but the licensing wouldn't work out in that situation. But for the academic environment, this is perfect. People can self-publish. They can also print anything that's out of copyright, public domain, or open source documents, as long as the licensing permits an actual printed physical copy. Other than that, people have printed blank notebooks that they've designed, photography books.
But of course, the espresso book machine prints more than just academic needs.
today we had a graduate student come in and print a Christmas book of his own comic art that he drew and illustrated, and it was online, but he wanted to give it as a gift to his mom, and so he printed it here. Anything they can think of to print, as long as you can get it into a PDF portable document file format, we can print it, as long as you have the rights to print it. Most of our books, we can tell that it has been student or, you know, personal written things. There's been one or two occasions where somebody has come in having added their own personal notes to somebody else's work, and we've said, no, we can't print that at this time. Please go contact the copyright owner, secure licensing rights, and then we can print it. And that has happened.
For self-annotation.
Correct.
And for Julie Taylor, though working with the Espresso book machine for just under a year, she still knows the ins and outs of the machine and talks about it frequently.
We give tours here at the library, both for students on campus, for community organizations, or even like elementary school students come in through here. So we have had many opportunities to explain how the machine works. So to print a book, we get the files on the computer and run them through pre-flight to make sure that the files are correctly formatted and that the cover size will match the actual book size. We can print as many copies as people want, whether they just want one copy or 50 or 200, that's fine. There are two printers, one for the cover that prints an 11 by 17 sheet of paper and feeds directly into the machine. The Xerox copier also prints the interior pages. Once it's ready to bind, it lets us know, and we can press the binding button or have it auto-bind. It'll clamp the pages and rotate them spine down. It'll then run a glue pot underneath the spine and back, spreading a thin layer of glue along the spine, and then press that onto the back of the cover. It sits there for about 12 seconds for the glue to harden, and then it passes it down to the bottom half of the machine, where it will trim the top, bottom, and outside edge and deposit the book in a tray.
Even though the Espresso book machine has been at the MSU library for a few years, computing technology has become more cloud-driven. And that seems to also be reflected in the methods and, indeed, the locations that Espresso books are sent.
People still come in with flash drives, but we work with people in New Jersey and Texas and print and ship books to them as well. We transfer or Dropbox or MSU File Depot. There are so many ways people can send us files. And as long as they're PDFs and they fit the format of the EBM, we can print them.
From the MSU Library's Espresso Book Machine, for WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And you've got Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero is expected to run for re-election this year. Along with choosing a mayor, voters will consider four seats on the city council. WKAR Scott Pohl talks with Lansing City Pulse publisher Burl Schwartz about the 2017 elections in Lansing. Schwartz says Mayor Bernero's options are limited.
I think one of Virge's problems is he doesn't seem to have other political options, perhaps because he did so poorly when he ran as the Democratic candidate for governor. There are people who look ahead and say, well, if the Democrats get to redistrict come 2020, then he might take on Mike Bishop in Congress. But as of right now, if Virge wants to stay in politics, this is the job he needs to win again.
What would you say are the accomplishments of the last 4 years that he would point to, and where do you think maybe he has failed since the 2013 election?
Well, I think that the accomplishments lie mainly in getting the city back out of its deficit financially, that the city actually survived the 2008 recession, which, of course, in Michigan dragged on until the last year or two. He's put up a good fight as far as pension benefits and legacy spending that he can't do a whole lot about. He's been open-minded. He's looking at the possibility of selling BWL. And he says, quite frankly, the city could still go bankrupt. Biggest failings he's had are this will be the first election since the 2013 ice storm. And, you know, he's going to have to deal now, first of all, with how he handled the general manager situation, first strongly supporting Peter Lark, then firing him, essentially. He gave permission to the BWL board to do that. And then on the heels of that came the city attorney, Janine McIntyre controversy, where after he changed the city charter to not allow for payouts, he paid her off and will not say why.
I want to talk about potential challengers now, and a couple of pretty prominent names have been coming up, so let's talk about them in alphabetical order for no particular reason other than that, okay? Judy Brown Clark, an at-large city council member. What are your odds that she'll run for mayor as opposed to running for re-election to the city council?
Yeah, I think she's much more likely to run for re-election to the city council. I think there have been a couple of polls now, one by City Pulse, another by DeSanto Strategies, that show her lagging a distant third in a race for mayor. Secondly, she doesn't get a free pass on this one. She either gives up her city council seat and runs for mayor, or she runs again for the city council and very likely would get reelected.
Can't do both. City charter, would that be correct?
Correct.
Okay. Secondly, now, State Representative Andy Shore's name is bandied about a lot. He's entering his third and final term in the state house. What are your odds on him opposing Virge Bernero?
Well, first let me say that I salivate at the idea he would, as a journalist, that he would run, because it would be some race, I think, between Bernero and Andy Shore. Shore is a successful politician. He is well-regarded, and he would contrast nicely with the angriest mayor in America by being the nicest mayor candidate in America. Andy's problem is whether he can raise the money to do it. And I think a lot of people want him to go for it, but he has told me on the record that his biggest concern is if he does run, that the mayor will run a very negative campaign against him. And Andy said, I need the money to be able to counter that. Now, he's facing considerable difficult odds, because the chamber has always supported Bernero, and the UAW has always supported Bernero. But Andy says they've made it clear to him they are going to listen to all candidates and make up their minds. And I have heard from high up in the chamber that indeed they are going to be open-minded. Their biggest concern is that the mayor is too outspoken when it comes to dealing with other partners in regionalism in our area. So they would like to see a calmer, cooler mayor, but whether they want to back a different horse is still very much up in the air.
Would it essentially be risk-free for Andy Shore to run for mayor?
No,
politically?
Yeah, politically he doesn't have to worry. He's been term limited. He can't run again for the House. He's not going to run for the Senate against Curtis Hertel. But one of the interesting things going on behind the scenes is that the mayor has floated the theory that Andy Shore needs a job. But really, it may be the other way around, that it's Bernero who needs a job. Andy Shore has a background in association work. And if Gretchen Whitmer runs for governor, if Gretchen Whitmer wins, Andy Shore would be in a very good position to play a leading role in that administration.
Are any other names being floated
around?
Not
that I have heard at all.
All right. We're talking with Beryl Schwartz of the Lansing City Pulse about what the 2017 election in the city of Lansing might wind up looking like. Four city council seats are up for grabs in 2017. Judy Brown Clark, you're speculating, is likely to run for re-election as opposed to running for mayor. The other at-large seat that will be up for election is Kathy Dunbars. Do you think she's going to run again?
I'm confident Kathy will run again, and so far I haven't heard of anyone running against her. There will undoubtedly be people, but I have not heard anybody prominent who's even interested.
The other two seats are held by Tina Houghton and Jessica Yorko. Let's talk about Ward 2 first, Tina Houghton.
Tina Houghton is likely to draw opposition, and I cannot put my finger on exactly why, but one of the people who's put out feelers is the recently retired internal auditor for City Council, Jim DeLine. He's 63 years old. He points out that all the rest of them have jobs and that he would be able to devote himself entirely to it. But I think the biggest thing Jim DeLine has going for him is he's got an MBA from the Broad School. And he ran the budget for the police department for many years before City Council hired him as internal auditor. He knows his numbers, and he made a point when I talked to him of saying that we need to look into all these tax breaks that developers are getting. I would say that alone probably puts him in the anti-Brunero camp.
And that could be enough in some cases to win.
Yes,
correct?
Because, you know, this year, I think more than ever, there's a feeling that people are starting to grow tired of the mayor. They're tired of the angriest mayor in America. And they were upset by what happened with Jeanine McIntyre on the heels of J. Peter Lark. So we could see some for Verge and against Verge candidates.
Is Jessica Yorko likely to seek
another term? Well, there's also in the second ward a possible other candidate, Julie Rodacker, who ran for the Lansing School Board, came in fifth out of six. Now, she has been appointed to a couple of city boards, suggesting that she would be in the Verge camp. Tina Houghton is very much in the Verge camp, however. She's former president of City Council, well-regarded, but a very low-key person, and someone may take her on, and so it could be a strategy of Brunero's. Let's have Julie Rodacker in there, and if Tina Houghton doesn't make it.
Thanks for steering us back there.
Right, and in the fourth ward. Yes, I think Jessica Yorko is going to have quite a fight. Jim McClurkin, who is one of the owners of the Potter House with his partner, is very well known in the community, especially in progressive politics. He has opened up that house for many, many fundraisers over the years. And secondly, he's a member of the park board and was a very vocal opponent of the BWL plan for Scott Park. And he has told me he's running. He's actually said he's got commitments from Joe DeSanto and Emily Devendorf to work on his campaign staff. And what's motivated him to run against Jessica is that Jessica voted for the BWL power station to replace the sunken garden in the Scott House. Jim will be formidable, and he says he is running.
Of the four council seats up for re-election, are any of the incumbents facing personal or professional issues that you think might lead them to decide not to run for re-election?
I have not heard anybody indicating they are not going to run.
Burl Schwartz is the founder and publisher of the Lansing City Pulse newspaper. Burl, thank you.
My pleasure, Scott.
This is Scott Pohl.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. It's sometimes easier to associate homelessness with a large urban setting, but smaller communities also have residents who struggle with homelessness. Today on Current State's Neighbors in Action, we're learning about a recently launched effort to serve homeless people in Shiawassee County. Walls of Warmth is a rotating shelter with area churches serving as host sites. To learn more, we welcome two key administrators of Walls of Warmth. Marlene Webster is a pastor and the coordinator of the organization. She's also the founder and executive director of a related and important community service organization, Shiawassee Hope. Welcome, Marlene.
Thank you.
And Samantha Ardeline is the organization's administrative assistant and a former beneficiary of services of Shiawassee Hope. Welcome, Samantha.
Thank you.
Marlene, you launched Walls of Warmth, or WOW, just about a year ago. What led you to start the effort?
Well, there were several of us who had been working in our community and were aware that there were homeless people. We didn't really know how many, and we try to get some counts, but it's a difficult number to count when you don't have any structured shelters. People are sort of scattered throughout a rural area, and to really know exactly how many homeless people we had was difficult to know. But through several agencies' work and reporting, we knew that we had a problem. And so I was approached by a community member who had heard about a rotating shelter model where local churches would host homeless people. And so we started thinking about it in October of last year, 2015, and actually launched in January of 2016.
Samantha, so these are rotating shelters. Tell us a little more about how that works.
Correct. So the guests stay with one church for 1 week at a time, and then on Sundays it's switched to a different church.
Okay. How do people know which shelter to go to or which churches?
So as far as the volunteers are concerned, it's listed on the sign up, and then the guests are transported from the Welcome Center. The Welcome Center never changes. That's one location where they check into daily between 4:15 and 5:45.
That's Main Street?
Correct.
Owosso. Mm-hmm. We've seen some very cold weather this week. Are you busier? Is there more demand when the weather is so bitter?
It's been pretty consistent, actually, about the same since our season began. We've been housing anywhere between 14 to 20 people every night. We took actually a little dip over the holidays because some people did go home to family members, but we've been pretty consistent since mid-November.
And you were telling me, Marlene, that homelessness in Shiawassee County may not resemble homelessness in more urban areas. How is it different?
So in more urban areas, it's more visible because people tend to gather under bridges or in warm areas, and you can see a small camp of homeless people. In rural areas, people tend to be doubled up with other family members or staying with friends, and they become homeless very quickly when that sort of tenuous arrangement falls apart.
Samantha, we were talking about how Walls of Warmth is connected to this, to the larger organization, Shiawassee Hope, which offers other services so you offer other services beyond shelter. Talk to us about those.
So Shiawassee's Hope whole mission is to create community, to empower people to live creative, productive, and hopeful lives. Pastor Marlene started with Shiawassee Drug Court. So we have neighborhoods where we focus on drug court being one. There's a local trailer park being another, the alternative high school being another. And rather than like what most government agencies do with people where, well, you need to go do this and this, we try to bring resources to the person to make it a little less fragmented.
Again,
what it already is.
Again, Walls of Warmth was launched about a year ago. Describe how the WOW campaign a year ago went.
Well, it went very quickly because we were under a time crunch. We got the idea in October of 2015 and kept our first guests the first week of January in 2016. So it went really well. As soon as we started asking the community to participate, they started to respond in really an overwhelming way. And so if we had not had that sort of response, it would have been very difficult to pull together a shelter with so many moving parts in 10 weeks. We provide food, so dinner and breakfast, so people have to cook those meals. The donations for the meals have to be secured. All of the mattresses and bedding and all of the things that have to be laundered. I mean, there are hundreds of moving pieces. Mm-hmm. And so it was just really a tremendous response by volunteers and community members who really rose to the occasion to make this happen. So it was very, very rushed, but it pulled together.
I'm talking with Marlene Webster and Samantha Ardeline of the organization Walls of Warmth, which offers shelter and other services, other help beyond that to the homeless in Shiawassee County. Samantha, Neighbors in Action, this segment is mainly about volunteerism, and I know that fortunately you've got a lot of volunteers. Where do your volunteers come from?
So our volunteers come from the community, from churches, from people who have heard about the shelter and want to be involved. We do have trainings. A lot of people hear about that, but there's been a lot of support from the local churches, especially in Shiawassee County.
The story of how you two met is really interesting, and how you, Samantha, became associated with WOW is really interesting. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I am a recovering heroin addict, and I, like most addicts do, was in trouble with the law and was placed in a drug court 3 weeks away from having a baby. And Pastor Marlene at that point had decided, like I had been telling you, that drug court was going to be one of the neighborhoods that Shiawassee Hope worked
right.
with. So as I was being sentenced in a drug court, scared and not quite sure what was going to happen with my life and where I was headed from here, I seen Pastor Marlene sitting there and just like with a very warm, inviting aura that felt like home. And she, her and I became super close. She was there for the birth of my child, and then offered me a position within Shiawassee Hope. So it's just been amazing, really, being able to, I feel like I give back and I'm able to, I feel fulfilled. Mm. And yeah, it's been awesome.
You've got training sessions pretty regularly. We want to mention that. I know there are one or two this weekend and more next week for anybody listening in Shiawassee County or nearby who might want to get involved. How much budget do you have for this effort, Marlene?
Well, we had set out to raise $5,000, which is, I think, a surprisingly small number to people. That we were able to provide shelter for 5 months for that amount of money. But it is because of the volunteers. All of our staff, except one paid position for the shelter, as a shelter manager. So we offer just a small honorarium for a daily on-call sort of manager. But everyone else is volunteer, and that's why we have been able to provide shelter for so many people without any government funding or major grants. It's all just been through local donations and local volunteer hours.
I know your hope is to stop the rotating shelter approach and find or build, I guess, mm-hmm. a permanent shelter. How do you hope that will happen?
Well, I think that the rotating shelter has really raised awareness. I'm not sure that our community really understood the significance of our homeless problem until we started the rotating shelter. And now we've had pregnant women stay in our shelter. We've had families with young children, 1 and 2 and 3 year olds, stay in our shelter. And so Shiawassee County is no longer able to say that we don't have a homeless problem. And I think that the raising of awareness through the rotating shelter is going to bring the resources that we need to have the more permanent shelter. We could just do a lot better job if we didn't have to cook food in one place and transport it to another because of licensed kitchen issues and have to move 24 beds and 24 sets of bedding and 24 totes and all of the materials required to house people overnight every Sunday that mm-hmm. stuff gets moved. And so our resources and our people could be better spent in other ways. And I think we're going to be really close. I'm hoping by next winter to have a permanent shelter.
Your organization just got some assistance from Lansing's Homeless Angels Group. Tell us about that.
Actually, probably Samantha could talk more about that because she has been the direct connection with Mr. Carl.
Sure.
And he has been a tremendous support to us. So I'll let her speak to that.
Mike Carl's been on this program several yes. times with his work with Homeless Angels. So tell us about that, Samantha.
Yeah, so he's amazing. I reached out to him. He's somebody that I've always followed because I've been homeless in Lansing before. And so I reached out to him and he had me come out and gave me a tour of the hotel, all their paperwork and just how to like work out logistics of this. And has just been, somebody that I can call to be like, hey, this is happening. How do you guys deal with it? He's, donated a ton, whatever supplies we need for our guests. They're there offering diapers, whatever it is. So he's been amazing. Homeless Angels have really been supportive.
You mentioned the struggles you faced earlier in your life. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you feel like you've reached some equilibrium here now?
Absolutely.
On solid ground?
Yes, my life is very stable now, and the amazing women I have in my life is just, it blows my mind.
It must be especially gratifying to be working for the organization that helped you. Do you feel like the struggles you went through better qualifies you to work for Walls of Warmth in Shiawassee Hope?
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when you're going through something like that, I think that having somebody in your corner who's like, I'm not just telling you I know to pacify you, but I know because
right.
I lived it,
right.
Is big for that. So
we want to thank both of our guests for telling us about Walls of Warmth and other services offered by Shiawassee Hope. Those guests have been Samantha Ardeline, Walls of Warmth's administrative assistant, former beneficiary of services of Shiawassee Hope. Also, Marlene Webster, pastor and coordinator of Walls of Warmth in Shiawassee County, based in Owosso. Thanks to both of you. Continued success.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. We're glad you could join us. Monday on WKAR News, we'll learn what's in store at East Lansing's annual Midwinter Singing Festival. That's a chance for the community to get together and warm things up with a little group sing. We'll also get some reporting from the Detroit Auto Show next week. Also next week, we'll check in with a cast member from the musical about the great Carol King that's coming to Wharton Center. That's called Beautiful. All next week here on WKAR News. Current State will be back next weekend as well. Our Current State team includes Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and Jamie Paisley. Thanks also to engineer Drew Hill. Current State's executive producer is Peter Wharf. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great weekend. Take care.